So several years ago, I met a friend of mine for lunch. Not an unusual story. He was really excited. He wanted to get together. He had something to show me. And out of his briefcase, he pulled out a stack of papers. He said, "Look, I took a test. I want to show you the results." He had taken a DNA test. He was so excited to show me sort of the trail of his genetic code stretching back into ancient history. He says, "Look, you can see how some of my ancestors came out of Africa and turned into Asia, and then some turned into Europe." He said, "It's amazing." I was so excited. I vowed that day to have my DNA tested. I wanted to know. I wanted to be as excited as he was about getting this paper that would tell me about myself. I wanted to know something exotic, mysterious, something that would be transformative. I had seen those commercials. I bet you have, right? Have you seen them? Person gets it, they open it up, they start crying, they find that they parts of their lives they never knew. There's one commercial that I love. The person goes to all these places where their ancestors have been, and there's pictures, it's of her in this picture, and she's in the pool. It's like, great. And I went, I want that. I want that. So I sent away from my kit the same one he did, and I was waiting. Because part of this was fueled by the fact I really don't know much about my history. Three of my four grandparents were European. And I think they were like a lot of European grandparents. They got off the boat, and they didn't talk about where they came from. There really wasn't much conversation. Just, they came, we were here, they were Americans. I have my grandfather's Russian and English dictionary in my office, and a book he bought about how to become an American, and that was it. It was only after both my parents died, and somehow we were going through lots and lots of pictures, that ultimately we discovered photographs from Europe. We'd never seen them. And unfortunately, we didn't know who they were. So all of this fueled my desire. So I got my test. I did what you need to do to give it your DNA, sent it off, and waited. They said 4 weeks. Week 2.5, I started checking my email every day. How many people have done that? You go, you really want to see it. I keep on looking. I was wondering, I was hopeful, I was waiting, and it finally popped up. And I opened it up. You won't guess what it said. Diaspora Jew. Ashkenazic Jewish. I knew that. I didn't have to spend $129 to find out the history that I had already known. I knew it from a historical perspective. I had heard that, so that's all we knew. And exactly what the genetic test showed. So I actually went and I read about how did they figure that out? It's interesting, and there's lots of theories, and we don't have time to talk about it. It said exactly who European Ashkenazi Jews are has long been debated, the genetic issues. An analysis of the gene database shows that the original Ashkenazi Jews were about half European and half Middle Eastern. They lived in the medieval era about 600 to 800 years ago, according to the analysis, and numbered only about 350 people. Very small group out of which we came. That's probably also why Ashkenazic Jews have certain diseases, because there was a relatively small group. The only thing that was really good, I'm above average. Did anyone doubt that? No, that's a question. By 0.1%, I am more Neanderthal than most of you. Never mind, there's a whole series of jokes one could go along that. I'm sure one of my brothers has one. 0.1% more Neanderthal, because remember, about 100,000 years ago, these genetic tests go back that far, Homo sapiens were not the only humans running around the Earth. There were Neanderthals and Homo erectus, and we actually, in Homo sapiens, inbred with Neanderthal And eventually Homo sapiens won, but we still carry some of that genetic code. And then they said, I have some famous relatives, except I had to go back 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 years. Because ultimately, if you go back far enough, we're all related. And somewhere in your past, you're related to me, likely. And I'm related to you, and we all have someone famous. The other thought about this test is if everyone gets it and we begin to realize how closely related we are, maybe it would help us to see ourselves as so much more similar than we think we are. That we're really one large human family, genetically related, and that maybe if we did that, prejudice would subside and hatred and racism would be a thing of the past. So as I was studying all this, understanding our genetic relationships, understanding my personal genetic code, I was confronted with another reality at the same time about the nature of how I'm perceived by others. In Charlottesville, they were chanting, "Jews will not replace us." Even as I was learning about how connected many of us are, I was learning why others don't see me as belonging. We saw it. We all saw it in Charlottesville. It was open hatred and bigotry. And while genetic code provides one understanding of who a person is from a scientific perspective, narratives and cultural stereotypes provide another understanding of how a person is seen by others. And bigotry and prejudice are more powerful than science, as we're learning. And it seems to be also more enduring. We saw swastikas hauled out of the trash bin of history, tattooed on men, marching down the streets of America in 2017. We saw people giving the Nazi salute and shouting Sieg Heil, a chant used by Nazis who murdered 6 million Jews, 5 million other innocent people in their death camps, started a Second World War that killed millions more. These people were marching on the streets of America in the shadow of the Holocaust, when there are survivors still living among us who heard those words for the first time. We heard the chant, "Blood and soil," a Nazi ideological phrase. And in front of the synagogue in Charlottesville on that Sabbath, when Jews had gathered for services, there stood across the street men dressed in fatigues carrying weapons. If not a direct threat, then indeed it was meant to intimidate and to strike fear. It was a form of psychological terrorism by Americans against Americans because they're Jewish. These historic symbols were taken from the past to evoke fear and declare without hesitation that those who chanted it were superior. And remember, in the midst of this, Heather Heyer was killed and several others wounded when a white supremacist intentionally drove his car into the crowd. A killing called by our Congress a domestic terrorist act. And this gathering in Charlottesville was about white supremacists protesting the taking down of the statue of Robert E. Lee, who led the pro-slavery Confederacy. And yet, even as the protests were about history and how it's supposed to be seen, American history, the protests turned from that to chanting anti-Semitic slogans. For those chanting anti-Semitic slogans or giving the Nazi salute, if I had run over and showed them my DNA that I had just gotten, that my roots were the same as theirs, they likely would have beaten me up. For as David Duke said when he was there that day, he said, "The American media, the American political system, and the American Federal Reserve is dominated by a tiny minority, the Jewish Zionist cause." for the white supremacists, anti-Semitism is a component of their bigotry. For the anti-Semite, the white supremacist, the bigot, the narrative overwhelms any facts. They have created a convoluted and twisted understanding of history, and it poisons our society, and it's toxic, and it does harm to all that it touches. This twisted narrative is about who is a real American and who isn't. It's about who belongs here and who doesn't. It's about who deserves a hand up and who deserves to be held down or worse. It's about power. It's about control. It is about injustice and about subverting the values and principle our nation was conceived upon: equality and justice for all. Regrettably, this Nazi ideology not only permeates our society more and more, it is growing. Anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. surged more than one-third in 2016 and have jumped 86% in the first quarter of 2017. This according to the Anti-Defamation League. But we need to understand that it's not just anti-Semitism that we think about this night, because hate speech is rising in many sectors. Anti-Muslim hate groups are growing, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. It grew from 34 in 2015 to 101 in 2016. Violence against the LGBT community has increased. More LGBT people have been killed in 2017 than were killed in all of 2016. Fox News noted that hate crimes in the U.S. are on the rise, and the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State just released this report. They found the number of hate crimes rose across the United States in 2016, marking the first time in over a decade that the country has experienced consecutive annual increases in crimes targeting people based upon their race, religion, sexuality, disability, or national origin. The rise of white supremacy, which includes overt anti-Semitism, is likely the result of multiple factors. Each magnify and amplify the other. Each alone is a problem, but together they grow larger and stronger. Yes, racism and prejudice have existed in society before, but the statistics and common sense says there's something different today. Now, white supremacists are emboldened. They march down the streets of our cities, not in the darkness of night, not wearing hoods, but in the light of day, proudly declaring their hate, shouting their words of violence. They aren't ashamed. They're proud. Their actions are a result of multiple factors. People have tried to understand it. Some include the election of our first African-American president. Well, the election of President Obama was historic. It also seemed to engender angst and rage from racists. There were those even who said he was not a legitimate president. This most recent presidential election, this last right cycle, we saw xenophobia, misogyny, anti-Mexican, anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim rhetoric regularly. And worse, it proved to be effective. We have an administration that's been slow to denounce white supremacy, and in fact seems comfortable with some who traffic in that horrific ideology. And for those of you who say, oh, Bob, you're just that liberal rabbi saying those things, because that's the easy way to discount things like this, there was a joint resolution of the Congress of the United States of America, a bipartisan resolution saying and condemning white nationalists, white supremacists, the Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis, and other hate groups. They passed that resolution in order that the president would sign it. All of this and probably more are rising the hate that we're hearing. And while it would be helpful to identify all the threads of this ugly tapestry, we may not be able to do so. And more, we don't have the luxury we need to respond now. I would suggest we are standing in a moment in time as a nation and as citizens and as Jews that we must stand up and respond to what's happening. Others have done it before us. In the 30s, Rabbi Stephen Wise of New York would preach to his congregation, Carnegie Hall. It was full. Thousands of people, Jews and non-Jews, would come to hear him give full-throated denunciation of anti-Semitism. Other generations have done it before us. We're not the first. We need to stand up and take our responsibility. And our concerns cannot only be for those who give the Nazi salutes. There are others who dabble in bigotry and prejudice in less offensive and less overt ways. Radio talk show hosts, and even politicians who use code words so they have deniability, but evoke the same kind of raw anger. Stephen Hahn, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian at New York University, observed, "It's like in the 1920s, the Ku Klux Klan. What was striking was not the number of KKK members," he said, "but the number of people who were allies of the group. Today, the number of white nationalists don't actually reveal the range of people who sympathize with them." This trend of those who sympathize and the politicalization of almost every conversation that now takes place is making it harder for us to talk about prejudice, racism. And if it's hard to talk about, it then becomes impossible to address. We as Americans, and as Jews, as individuals, and as community, as organizations, and as congregations, we are obliged to respond. And we do so first by turning our own vision inward. We need to ask ourselves about what prejudices we may carry. Not that they're equivalent to the ugliness we've seen, but an honest assessment of ourselves helps us to try to move through this morass and work in coalitions with others. We need to understand our own blind spots as we navigate the challenges of fighting intolerance, even as we need to understand the privileges that we may have enjoyed. Personal self-examination is never easy, but that's what Rosh Hashanah calls us to do, to see if we've lived up to our values and to acknowledge if we've fallen short. And as a Jewish community, we need to talk collectively about anti-Semitism and how we're going to respond, but this is not an easy task. For to engage in honest, heartfelt conversation is risky. And unfortunately, in our political climate today, it's getting rarer. We, the Jewish people, like others in America, are finding it more and more difficult to have civil conversations and to have productive conversations. I have witnessed conversations within the Jewish community about anti-Semitism that devolve into debate about who is more anti-Semitic, the left or the right. And then it devolves into is it Democrat or Republican, and then it stems into what about the security of Israel? The conversation spins out of control, and we find no resolution. Community conversations about anti-Semitism will require us to break this cycle, to go beyond party politics, and to realize that the future of our nation is at stake. And we need to realize that prejudice begets prejudice. We cannot focus alone on anti-Semitism and not recognize that prejudice against one group forms a foundation for the prejudice against others. Talking and working together means we're going to have to stretch ourselves. We're going to have to place ourselves in conversations which may be uncomfortable. We can't see ourselves in competition with other groups and say, oh, we're more marginalized than you. We're more hated. We need to understand that in a civil society where equality and justice is given to all, we all do better. We need to recognize prejudice and bigotry against one group is undermining the values and principles of our entire nation. Dr. Martin Luther King, in his letter for the Birmingham jail, reminded us, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment, he wrote, of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Charlene Galton, writing about what was happening in Charlottesville, noted, if anything, Charlottesville proved that hatred is cyclical. It may focus on one group today and another tomorrow, and it will come around again and again until someone stops the wheel from turning. It's our responsibility to stop the wheel, to stand up against injustice, to denounce prejudice where and when we see it, to hold our elected officials accountable if they dabble in such offensive language or ideology. Prejudice and bigotry are like fire, destructive, and left unchecked grows more violent and more powerful. A few moments ago in our service, we all read a passage together. We said, each of us leaves a legacy. Our legacy must be that we cared and that we made a difference, that our moment in history, our moment is significant, and that we took responsibility for the world we left. This time is ours. The time to act is now.